Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. And today we have a very esteemed guest. His name is Anthony J. Moore, and he is the author of Every Other Weekend, Coming of Age with Two Different Dads. Anthony, or Tony as we know him, is an author, a superior court judge in California, a husband, and a traveler. Welcome, Tony. Hello.
Hillary, hello. Thank you for having me on. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. I so enjoyed your book. So, well, I'll call him Tony instead of being formal. But so Tony's book is very, it's about his childhood growing up. And I know I should let him tell you the story. But if any of you have read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I know back in the, I don't know, maybe it was the 90s, that was a big thing. He had a whole brand. He had his real father, and then he had his friend's father. Well, Tony has a sort of similar situation, similar but different. And anyway, he's share. I know I should let you talk, but I'm going to keep going for a second. He's putting this out there, his book and the interview, so that if other people have grown up in divorced households where they might have had two different parents or just a divorced household in general, you could be inspired and learn from Tony's experience. So, Tony, what would you like to say about that?
Well, a lot. I'll try to compress it. First of all, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which is a fun book, is a how-to book. Okay. Mine is more of a memoir, if it is. It's more of a story of, you know, my coming of age with two different dads. From the financial point of view, Rich Dad, Poor Dad is how do you make money? And the friend's father basically gives him a lot of pointers, starting with going to making him work for like 30 cents an hour or something like that. The way finances work in my book is really my own father was not doing very well financially after the divorce for many reasons, one of which was the divorce. That was a scandalous move back in the late 50s. But beyond that, he made a couple of career mistakes, which I talk about in the book. One of which was turning down the lead in Wyatt Earp. Hugh O'Brien got the part. He wanted to work in Europe, be the international man of mystery. So he took the lead in a TV series, which was going to its third season and was not doing well. So at the same time, my stepfather was very successful with his own company. He was your basic serial entrepreneur. And his company at that time, at Dashie Business Machines, made the machinery that imprinted and embossed credit cards. They partnered with Bank of America, which had actually started the Bank of America card, now known as Visa. And so one weekend I'm with my stepdad, who's doing very well. We've got our house in Beverly Hills. He's got a house in Newport Beach. He's got a 58-foot catamaran. We're in Beverly Hills. The next weekend I'm with my father and his second wife. And money is tight. That's quote unquote what he would always say. And his second wife was rather disappointed about that. And she made it known very, very often that they didn't have money. At one point, she blurted out to me over dinner, "Don't you realize that we're poor?" So it was really a juxtaposition in financial standing, if you will.
Now, when you say, I know we're skipping over your childhood, but when you said that the divorce impacted him financially, what do you mean by that?
California back then, as most places, was a fault state. And my father was at fault. He left my mother for another woman. And So at the end of the day, the settlement was extremely favorable for my mother. My dad was left with about $5,000, and that was all. That and his 1952 Jaguar. So he didn't have a lot of cash. He didn't have a lot of resources, and didn't own a house. He lived in an apartment. And when he married Mai, they moved into a little house in Hollywood in the Flatlands. And you know, as I said, the resources were thin, which was quite different from my mother and Stan. They moved into a lovely little house in Beverly Hills.
Yeah. Now, I remember in the book, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but when he would get his unemployment check, and then he would go out and you guys would go spend it. I don't know if he spent all of it, but would you say his spending habits contributed to that, or it just was a lack of being able to make money as an actor?
The latter. His spending habits were not profligate. They were not careless. They were not free, if you will. He'd get his unemployment cash. I mean, they always doled out some bills to him. And we'd go play miniature golf. Maybe it cost $1.50 back then or $2 to play a round or two. And we'd do that. We'd go to the Gittleson Brothers golf course, which was on Hollywood Boulevard in East Hollywood. And we'd play. I loved the game. Or we'd go up to the Sportsman's Lodge and maybe fish for our dinner, because they had a pond and you could fish. And if you caught a trout, they'd cook it. And that was your meal. But that was not, lavish spending at all. My dad was frugal. He had to be, and he wasn't trying to impress anybody with becoming a big spender, if you will.
Right. Okay. All right. So let's backtrack a little bit to your childhood. Some people may recognize your father's name as first he was a radio star, right?
Yeah, before I was born, and then in the first few years of my life, he did a lot of radio plays. The best one, the one he's best known for, was playing Philip Marlowe on the radio, which he did for several years, including when I was born, all the way up to maybe 1951 or something like that. So I remember hearing his voice on the radio when I was falling asleep. But he was extremely well known. He won awards. They called him the Iron Duke because he never flubbed his lines. But radio began to go out of style, and he had to adapt to television. And that took some doing. He managed it, but it wasn't easy.
So his name, you haven't said his name yet, right? For people I know.
Gerald Moore.
And so one of the lines you said, let's see if I could find it here. So you said, but the one stubborn fact I never forgot was that during the opening years of my life, my father's role had been little more than a voice I heard in the dark.
Right. He wasn't around that much. He was working. I don't think he ever really knew how to deal with an infant or a toddler. And he admitted that to me later. As I got older, we drew closer. But as an infant or a toddler, he didn't have the ability, if you will. So he's working. He's not that attentive. And I'm falling asleep hearing his voice as I'm falling asleep and with the radio playing.
Wow. Okay. So then when did things start to change? When the radio business, you said they used to have all these parties, right? So you would get for them having parties downstairs, and they were all put to famous people, right?
Dad was very social. They had a lovely group of friends, most of whom I really never met, or if I did, it was very quick, so I can't remember all the names. But a number of the people were known. They were actors, not well-known actors, but actors. His best-known actor friend was Jeff Chandler. They were extremely close. In fact, my dad was a pallbearer at Jeff's funeral. There was a guy named Jack Rubin. He was a screenwriter, and Beulah, his wife, and my mother were extremely close friends, dating back to high school. Jack died early of a heart attack. And I found out later it was after he learned that a girl he was having an affair with became pregnant, which of course is a crisis back then because abortions were illegal. Unless if you didn't have the money to fly to Sweden or someplace, you were definitely on the horns of a dilemma, if you will. But Jack died young, somewhere in his early 40s. Then Beulah married Sumner Long, who also was a very well-known writer and playwright, and he had a huge Broadway hit, Never Too Late. But at the parties, all these people would come, and the actors would act, and they'd play, and they'd jump around the living room, and they had, you know, all sorts of conversations. He, you know, I'm, what, 4 or 5 years old, so I can't recall what the conversations are about. Mm. I just recall a lot of laughter, a lot of merriment, gaiety, people having a ball, just having a ball. And my father led the pack. He was social. He was the... You know, he was the life of the party, telling great jokes. I still remember a couple of them, which I think I put in the book. And they weren't jokes that if I told would make you laugh. But when he told them, people laughed. He knew how to do it. He could tell a joke. In fact, James Garner, in his memoir, said that. He said, my dad could tell a joke better than anybody.
Wow. So why do you think they were at your house?
It was a lovely house. In Sherman Oaks, which was a nice area of the San Fernando Valley. It still is. And the house was set up for entertainment. Huge living room with big vaulted beam ceilings, two patios outside. It was just a very cozy place. My mother was excellent at decorating, and she made the place look as hospitable and welcoming as you could ask for.
Wow. Okay. So you're little, everything's fine. Everyone's happy. Lots of parties.
Right.
When do you think things started to change? When the radio started switching to TV?
You know, it's hard to say. My father once told me that he knew or told my mother very early on that she married the wrong guy. And my mother essentially agreed. The reason I'm an only child, she told me once, was she didn't want to have another child because she wasn't sure the marriage was right. So she didn't want a second child. So I guess they kind of knew, but were moving along, just doing the best they could. Then my father goes to Sweden, and guess what happens in Sweden? He meets a Swedish girl.
Well, we'll back up a little. Did they have to get married because of you?
No.
Or they?
Oh, no. They were married at least 10 years before I was born.
Wow.
Yeah.
So even though he said she married the wrong guy, they were still together for quite a while.
Yeah, they were. They were. Interesting. You know, that's something that makes it a little difficult to sort out.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Is that your wife?
I think she closed the door and the door squeaky. So there you go.
Right, well, we're ready. We're ready for her to walk through.
Oh, she's going to come around now. She has to go to the staircase. Oh, there she is. You can wave. Beverly, wave at the gang. Okay.
Have a nice lunch. Hello. We're
off and running. Okay. Have a good lunch. Baby,
you look adorable.
Last stop, so.
Yeah, you look great.
Yeah.
I love
now she goes.
Okay. All right, very good. All right. So this is getting real with Hillary. So everything's real. So, okay, good. All right. So there you were. Now for you, you were happy because you had both parents and you had this nice life, right? And then all of a sudden your father goes to Sweden, off the plane comes him, and then... Well, you had been in Sweden.
Well, I was in Sweden with my mother and my father. So I was there and in a Swedish school for the year when I was in the second grade.
Wow.
Although they put me back a year because I didn't speak Swedish and I had to learn in school, which I did. And I met Mai over there. She came to the house. She kind of wormed her way into the family. And of course, I was a little as a child, you have no idea what's going on, but something rankled. Something made me not exactly welcoming to her. And when we left Sweden, I was kind of glad that I wouldn't see her again. But of course, I did. She came to California and got off the plane.
Now, did your mother have any suspicions or did you never talk to her about that?
My mother did not have any suspicions. She was naive about all of this. Mm. She had no idea. Even after the divorce, she wasn't sure my father was involved with Mai.
Wow. Now, had your father, I know later on in the story, there's other women and stuff. Do you think he was fooling around the whole time?
You bet.
Oh, he was. Okay.
I'm sure he was. Knowing him as I did. I'm sure he played around with his leading ladies, who were rather attractive, I must tell you. Somebody like Peggy Castle and Invasion USA. I wouldn't be surprised if they had a fling. There were others, maybe Nora Hayden in The Angry Red Planet, although she was married. Peggy wasn't. She was single. You know, I don't have proof, but I'm pretty sure he ran around. And one of my stepbrothers, one of Mai's children, and I were having dinner in Hawaii. Oh, this is probably 9 or 10 years ago. And Beverly, my wife, said, you know, did Jerry cheat? And all the time. And Tim looked at her and said, absolutely. We all thought that.
Now, did Beverly ever meet your father? Or he
No. He died in 68, and I met Beverly in, 1996 or 7.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Big gap there. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So, all right. So you're happy. You come back from Sweden. So your mom has no idea that any of this is going on, right? Anytime. Okay.
Right.
So then Mai gets off the plane. Well, whatever. And then all of a sudden your father wants to get a divorce. Is that how it went?
Within a few months, yes. I mean, he had gone back to Sweden to make another pilot for what they hope would be another series. So he comes off the plane with Mai, and he kept holding the can of film, which was the pilot, and saying to Mai, this is our baby. And it didn't quite register with me. I didn't understand why he would call a bunch of a film and a can a baby, but he did. We went home. He set up the projector in the living room. You had to have a projector back then to, you know, sets up the screen. We watched the thing. I'm bored as hell. I found the series as boring as all get out. But again, you know, what was I? I was 8 years old, you know, going on 9. So I don't know. I wish I could see it again. I've never found the film. So I don't know. But
and it never went anywhere, that film.
Oh, it never went anywhere at all. Yeah. And then somewhere in, I think, September of 56, the divorce occurred. They sat me down. They told me that Daddy wouldn't be living at the house anymore. I didn't quite understand what that was all about. I was fighting a bit of a cold that day. I remember that. And he moved out, and suddenly he's never at the house.
But it wasn't your mom's idea. It was him.
Hardly. She tried to save the marriage. In fact, one thing she did, which I didn't understand at the time, but I do now, is she started saying to me, you know, your father's a great guy. He's quite a guy. He's wonderful. Tonight, Tony, when he comes through the door, run and give him a hug and kiss.
Mm.
And she said that several times. And I couldn't quite understand why suddenly she was saying this after all these years. It was an effort, you know, in vain to save the marriage.
All right. So he moves out.
Yep.
You guys, after a little while, go back to New York.
Yeah. In the beginning of 58, because she had family there. She came from there. She wanted to go back with her brother and sister and her mother. So we moved back to New York City.
Now, did she sell the house, the nice house?
Unfortunately, she did. And I still have the contract of sale. I can't believe how little money the house fetched back in 1958.
Wow. Okay. So she didn't think she was coming back, I guess. To California.
I mean, it's too bad. I mean, today I could have put it on my American Express card. It was so cheap.
All right. So, and you were fairly miserable in New York, right? You didn't like it?
I was miserable the first few months in the fifth grade, not knowing anybody in the school, not liking the layout of New York City, you know, no lawns, no sunlight, you know, buildings, you know, cheek by jowl together. And we had a fifth grade teacher who was a monster. Miss Haper was an absolute miserable excuse for a human being. And I'm still friendly with a couple of people from that class. And one of whom and I had lunch about 3 months ago. We both agreed. Yeah, she was pathetic. So it wasn't good. when I started the sixth grade, I had another teacher, Miss Venaria, who was a lovely woman. And of course, things got better. And I was having more fun. One lovely thing about living in New York was PS6, the school I attended, was on Madison and 81st, which is one block from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And at lunch, a number of us would walk up to the museum and hang out.
Wow.
Go through the museum, look around, see the art, come back. We were kind of a bunch of little cultured kids.
Now, I know for some, did your mom ever work or how did she survive financially?
I'm sure her brother, Uncle Dick, helped her. Okay. She told me she was going to get a job, but right after that, she met Stan. So she never got a job, but she was going to. And she said to me one time, well, Tony, I think I'm going to get a job.
And had she worked before she got married, you know?
Oh, yeah. She in the Depression. She was a legal secretary. And I don't remember who she worked for, if I ever knew. But she did. And she made her few nickels and, you know, would go and spend a nickel for lunch during the Depression. You know, maybe get a little piece of bread with butter on it. And maybe dip it into it or put a little ketchup on it and call it tomatoes or with the ketchup in a cup of warm water and call it tomato soup and then go home and give the rest of her salary to her parents who needed it.
Wow. And yeah. Where did she meet your dad? In New York?
High school. They knew each other in high school. New Utrecht High School in Brooklyn. They came from Bensonhurst in Brooklyn.
Oh, so he wasn't. And then so then they moved out to California afterwards.
Not together. He goes out there. You know, he's making money in radio and he goes out there and he's doing really well in radio and made actually one or two movies. And then he calls my mother and says, you know, darling, I have $750 in the bank and I want to marry you. She takes the super chief out, or maybe it was the chief, one of the two trains, comes out to L.A. They get married around 1937.
Wow. So have they even been dating in New York?
I assume so, but how much, I really don't know. It's a good question I never asked.
Wow. Okay. All right. So there you are back in New York. And then who was the guy that told Stan to call your mom?
Oh, Mel Shavelson. He was a mutual friend. Mel came to a lot of our parties with his wife, Lucy. Mel was a writer. He was one of the writers for Bob Hope. He ended up becoming president of the Writers Guild West. Very, very clever guy. I mean, it was full of jokes and full of quips. But he also knew Stan because he and Stan had been in high school back in New York, in Suffern, New York.
Oh.
And they put out an underground newspaper called The Wasp, the newspaper with the hidden sting. And they got into trouble for doing it, but they did it. So Mel called Stan and said, look, I should have introduced you to this Rita Moore before before she moved to New York. But if you ever find yourself in New York, you should call her. Well, Stan had a business trip to Europe, which got delayed because he gets to New York and Joe Williams at Bank of America, the vice president, calls him and says he wants to make a deal to get, you know, use Stan's business machines to emboss and imprint these credit cards, which, you know, Joe has invented and they're coming out with. So he said, don't leave, you know, wait, I'm going to be talking to you. So Stan holds up in New York for a few days waiting for Destiny to call. And he calls my mother, says, hey, here I am. Mel Shavelson said I should call you. They went out and the first date included me because it was a Sunday and she always took me along for Sunday activities. We took the Staten Island Ferry there and back. I believe we had dinner together. The rest is history. It was a very fast courtship. They met in April and got married in December.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I think you said you kind of liked him because, well, it seemed like he paid attention to you.
He did. Well, first of all, I wanted my mother to get married again. She was very, very unhappy. And so as far as I'm concerned, she could have married, you know, Dracula and I would have been happy. I just wanted to see her married again. And she met there were a couple of guys. I remember one was Dr. Glass, who was kind of a total reading nerd that I didn't care for. But yeah, I wanted her married. If it had to be Dr. Glass, I would have, you know, gagged him down. But it wasn't Dr. Glass. Stan comes along, and yeah, we got along. He was an inveterate traveler. He had spent a year and a half on his own boat with his wife and kids. And he sailed from the Northeast down through the Caribbean, through the canal, and into Los Angeles. So he had a lot to talk about.
He sailed through the canal? Wow.
Yeah. And I had done the same. When we sailed home from Europe, we stopped in South America at Cartagena, Colombia. We went through the Panama Canal. So we had a little bit to talk about. And
wait, who had you done that with?
My parents, mom and dad, and my father's mother, Grandma Henny. When we left Europe, we sailed home. It was a 3-week trip.
How big was the boat?
It was a freighter that also included 12 passengers.
Oh, okay. You didn't come across the Atlantic on a tiny sailboat. Whatever.
This was a freighter, a big, big boat.
But I didn't know if Stan also went through the Panama Canal, because I just went through it a few years ago. I mean, it's like $500,000 or something to go through now. I wonder how much it was then. But you saw these huge monsters going through. I can't imagine a little sailboat, or was it not that little?
Well, it was a 76-foot schooner. I don't know what it costs to go through, but even now, if there are yachts that go through, I'm sure it doesn't cost $500,000, but they gather the yachts, stuff them into one of the locks, and then they go up and across and down all together.
Okay.
Exactly what the procedure is, I don't know. I keep wanting to do the canal again, but I have yet to do so.
Oh, I see. So they fit a bunch of them in one.
Oh, sure.
Wow.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's such a, if you haven't been to the Panama Canal, it's quite, my father loved it. My father's passed away, but that was, I found a letter from him after I had said I was going on this vacation course. And he had written like 13 pages. He just found it fascinating. And so I was like, all right, I'll go check it out. And it was so interesting, right? The way they did that back in the 1900s, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it was built in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
But the locks are neat, the electric mules that pull the ships through. And then you go on your own power across Gatun Lake to the next set of locks, and then up or down, depending on which side of the canal you're on.
Yeah. Anyway, so, okay. So you meet Stan, and I remember you had said, or you were going in and getting all those travel brochures.
Yeah, I would run down and bounce into every single travel agency on Fifth Avenue and grab brochures and all of that, and then come back. But Stan, he had been all over the place, and so he would tell me about his ports of call, which were exotic and fascinating.
But it seemed like, as opposed to your dad, that he was, he noticed you were gathering those brochures, and so he engaged you in conversation about them, right?
Yes. Yes, he did.
Whereas, would you think Gerald would have noticed?
I don't know. I remember he would take me to Cy DeVore, which was a men's shop, catering a lot to Hollywood celebrities. And I think it was on Vine Street back then. But it was boring. And I didn't care about clothes. So I'd go next door or up the street and try to find a travel agency. And if I'm not mistaken, I found one or two. But I don't remember my father asking me about it. Later, we talked about everything under the sun, including foreign policy, politics, the supernatural, Shakespeare, the space race. He was, in many ways a polymath and an intellectual, but I don't remember him really focusing on travel for me.
Right, right. Huh. So it's kind of like you had certain topics with Stan, certain topics with your dad, right?
The topics with Stan after the marriage were really two things. One was business, the other was sailing. Stan was kind of a one-trick pony in that area. We really didn't get involved in other discussions. Sometimes politics, during the 1960 election, we talked about it. He was a very solid Republican. He pro-Nixon all the way. My dad was the other way. He was pro-L.A. Stevenson and then adored Jack Kennedy and ended up campaigning for Bobby Kennedy. He was at the ambassador when Bobby was killed.
Wow. So, okay. So, Stan, now, do you think your mom was happy? Like you said, maybe Gerald was the wrong guy, but was Stan the right guy?
It was a storybook marriage.
It was.
They were both supremely happy.
Oh.
Supremely happy. He did everything he could to make her happy, and she did everything she could to, you know, keep him happy. He loved her without let up. After she died, he never got over her. He did end up with a second woman, sort of. Not really, but sort of. But he missed my mother all the way down to the end. Yeah.
All right. So we're going to talk more about, you know, what it was like living between the two after our commercial break. We're going to go to a commercial now, and then we'll be back with more from Anthony J. Moore, author of Every Other Weekend, Coming of Age with Two Different Dads. All right, we'll be right back.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you would like to bring experiential social-emotional learning to your schools, teams, businesses, check them out. It really does foster a connection, socialization, and after COVID, which is seeming like a faint memory at this point, you know, it's important. It's important for people to connect, especially your children. And then if you have not read my memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, you can find it on Amazon. It's a very courageous story about how I found myself wondering what had happened to me after I got married. The subtitle, If Marriage Was My Dream, Why Was I Numbing Myself? So if you're a number, you might want to check this out. It might shed some light on what you're doing to yourself. It certainly shed some on mine. We also have Your Bullshit Is Your Blessing. I found that I sort of had 2 sides of life. One that wasn't so good. Things looked bleak. Something was wrong with me. Something was wrong with the world. And then there was another side that was really fun. Everything was possible. And I was having a ball. So I decided to discover techniques for spending less time on the left and more on the right, where things were fun. So this one is Your Bullshit Is Your Blessing, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. Also, you can find this on Amazon. And then we have Real Talk. Real Talk is because when I wrote my first book, someone said to me, why didn't you speak up? And I didn't even know that I wasn't. I really had no idea. So speaking up took something. That's why this book, if you want to check it out, go to realtalkwithhillary.com. That's with 1L. You can schedule a time to talk and we will get you talking. And life is way more fun that way. Okay, and now we're going to bring back Anthony J. Moore, author of Every Other Weekend.
Okay, good.
Hello. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you again. All I enjoyed right. hearing what you said about your books.
Oh, good. Yes. Yeah. I'm trying to be more creative with the discussions because, you know, you get used to it, right? You kind of get numb to what you're saying. So I'm trying to put more enthusiasm in because obviously I wrote them and they're part of my life.
Right.
And anyway, all right. So we want to make a difference with people, you know, maybe who were divorced, maybe from divorced families. And as from your perspective as a child in a divorced home, I know you have some insights as to what might make it better for other people who are going through that.
Yeah. Well, from the perspective of parents, if you've got kids and you're going to get a divorce, I don't care how old they are, assuming they're still minors, get the kid into therapy. The child may be or appear to be very well adjusted, taking the divorce like a champ, just kind of skating through it. Chances are that's not the case. So I would say, if nothing else, arrange a session with a therapist. And just make sure that the kid is doing okay, because a lot of them are not. You know, I've seen a lot of children of divorced parents who were miserable and they don't show it, but it, you know, pops up later in life or it you know, interferes with them in school. I know with me, I was extremely great in school through the third grade. I still have the report cards, believe it or not. And I was sort of straight A in the third grade. Then the divorce occurred in the fourth. And my grades slipped. And more than that, my conduct slipped. The LA schools had something like 10 or 11 categories for your conduct and citizenship. And every one of mine fell. So clearly something had gone wrong. Fortunately, I recovered. I had a great fifth grade teacher. In fact, I wrote about him in the book. And I didn't when we moved to New York, but at least I did for a little while in California before we left. And so I recovered and did fine in school, but not everybody does. So that would be my.
Would you
go ahead?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Would you? No, I'm just like, you know, reading the book, you could see something was wrong. But what do you think it was that had you go from the straight A's to not? Were you confused? Did you feel lost? Like what?
Both of the above. You know, all you know is suddenly the house is empty. Now. At the dinner table, no father. During the day, no father. Just my mother. And believe it or not, my father's mother, Grandma Henny, lived in a granny flat in the house. She always was there. In fact, she came to Sweden with us. And she didn't move out when my father moved out. Mm. So here's my mother living with the mother of the man who left her for another woman. Yeah. Wrap your mind around that one. And
did she mind? Did she ever say anything?
Well, Grandma did not like mine. Grandma disliked her intensely. And in fact, when my father had, and we'll get to this, I'm sure, when he started having a long-running affair that he brought me into, my grandmother really enabled it. You know, she would loan out her apartment. My mother ultimately got my grandmother to move out. She said, look, Henny, this isn't right. The optics are bad. You've got to leave. And my grandmother left. Of course, I didn't understand why. Why can't grandma stay here? Well, you know, there are reasons, you know, kid, you're too young to understand them. She got to get the hell out. I just recall it was a very lonely time. And I was confused. You know, why is daddy gone? You know, no idea.
But so it's like life changes.
Life changes.
It's weird.
It's weird. It made the papers, although that didn't touch me at the time. I found out later. I was going through some stuff in our storage house, and suddenly I found articles in the press about the divorce.
Wow. And so it wasn't done. So what would you say, like, just in case other people are seeing their child change, you were like, did you just not care anymore? Like about the school? Like, what do you think you were?
I probably cared. The subject I did the worst in was social studies. I absolutely fell into the cellar in that subject, which was bizarre because in high school, I got my highest honors in social studies and graduated college with honors in government, you know, went to law school. But that was the one subject that fell apart. You know, maybe social studies, it's, you know, connects in with being lonely and not having a lot of friends, whatever it was.
Yeah. Oh. Well, you had gone from New York. So was that before you went to New York or was that when you came back?
This was before New York.
Okay.
This was before New York.
All right.
Fourth grade.
But then you had the one teacher who really kind of knew what you were going through.
Yeah.
And what did he say to you? He said,
Pepe Hernandez. He was a substitute teacher, but he also was an actor. And he had, I think he acted with my father in some TV show. And he played in Zorro, which was my favorite TV series back then. And Pepe was very understanding. He really was. He talked to me alone and just really made me feel better. Just a fabulous human being.
And that was what turned you back around, right?
It helped me. Yeah. It started me on the road to recovery, if you will.
Okay. Because I think, you know, let's say you're a parent, your mother was, she was upset.
Yep.
She was probably wondering what the heck was going to happen to her. And I remember when I went through my divorce, you're kind of like, not in survival, but you're just in a really weird place. So I could see where kids can fall through the cracks.
Oh, I knew my mother wasn't happy. It was obvious she wasn't happy.
So now you don't have a father and your mother's unhappy. And it's kind of like, what's going on here?
Right? I am seeing my father from time to time. And he is actually making an effort to, quote, be my pal, end quote. And we drew closer. You know, but again, now I'm older. I'm 9 years old. You know, I can talk. I have some thoughts. I'm not just a little toddler, you know, battling along with about nothing. So we're getting closer and I'm enjoying my time with him. And when we moved to New York, I missed him.
Mm.
And he really didn't write a lot. He wrote maybe one or two letters that I can recall at the time.
Wow. So you were happy to move back to California, right?
Ecstatically happy to come back to California. Very happy.
And was it weird to move into a house? Did Stan have his kids full time?
No, his two children live with his alcoholic ex-wife in I think it was North Hollywood or Van Nuys or Studio City, somewhere around there. And Skip was 16. He's 5 years older than I. So I'm 11. Skip's 16. The week after we moved into our place in Beverly Hills, Skip, you know, he booked. He left his mother and moved in with us. He said, that's it. I'm not living with my mother. I'm coming over. And wham, he installed himself, which was fine. I always wanted a brother, and an older brother was fine. I had met them over the summer. Mom and Stan had sort of a two-week trial period in Newport Beach at his place there for all the kids, and it worked out. So, you know, I had already met them. Leslie, the sister, who was 2 years younger, wanted to leave as well. And Stan said, no, you're still 9 years old. You need to live with your mother, which she didn't want to do. And it was really a source of sadness for her. I remember her calling her sometime and weeping into the phone, I don't want to live with my so-called mother anymore. And her mother was really a piece of work. Mm. And I said she was an alcoholic. Stan would send her child support, which included money for clothing. She wouldn't spend it on clothes. She probably spent it on alcohol. Who knows? But
did she die young too?
Died in her late 60s. I forget what of. She died on the table. That part I do remember.
Oh. So it didn't kill her right away. I mean, they obviously, if they went sailing for a year and a half, she had to have been okay to do that.
To do that. She was an artist. She did some sculpture, some paintings. She made some ceramics. Skip and Leslie still have some of them. She was very politically active on the Republican side, and I have some of those artifacts. Mementos from the Republican convention in 1956. or 52 or both. She was busy.
Okay. So then, some more advice for people, you know, either going through a divorce or who have been through a divorce. I know it seemed like your father, I don't know, was talking to you about sex early on.
Too early, frankly. Yeah, he was the grandmaster of sex. I mean, come on. He lost his virginity when he was 12 years old. You know?
He was
sort of the, you know, the undisputed maven of sex. And I'm this shy little kid, you know, and I've never even kissed a girl, for crying out loud. And so he's talking to me about, you know, using contraceptives and, you know, how to have sexual intercourse. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? You know, he's describing calculus, and I didn't even know the multiplication tables.
All right.
I will tell you this, though. If you're giving advice, you know, I said what parents should do, you know, get the kid to therapy. If you're a child and your parents divorce, become a judge. Become a judge. You are, especially after the next marriage, because you are now balancing two different families, two different cultures, two different households. You're trying to figure out which one is better, which one is worse, which one you like, which one you don't. Are they equal? Are they not? But you're weighing different, different cultures. And that's what a judge does. You hear different stories. You have to make up your mind, you know, who's right, who's wrong. Obviously, you have to figure out what the law is and follow the law. But a lot of it is credibility, especially when there's no jury. And, you know, at a young age, if you're doing that, that'll kind of get you into good practice. Did for me.
So there's no jury in your court.
Oh, there is. I mean, I've had jury trials and non-jury trials. But at a non-jury trial, the judge figures out the person to believe. Who's right? Who's right? Who's wrong? Who's lying? Who's telling the truth? In a jury trial, the judge doesn't do that. The jury does that. All the judge does is call balls and strikes based on evidence, and then instruct the jury in the law and try to keep the courtroom running, keep everything on an even keel. But in a jury trial, the judge does not decide credibility.
But sometimes you do, right?
Well, I mean, there are times. I don't want to get too into the legal thicket, but there are times when, yeah, a judge will decide credibility, but it's very rare. It's has nothing to do really with the merits of the case, unless you have what we call in California a 402 hearing, and sometimes there you will decide who's credible and who's not. But that's a very different situation. 99.9% of the time in a jury trial, the jury decides who's right, who's believable, who's lying.
Wow. All right. So back to your two different worlds there, and you're balancing them. Do you think that all children of divorce, I mean, I suppose if they're going back and forth between the father and the mother, they are. There's two different worlds, whether they're getting married again or not,
sure.
Right?
Sure. And I mean, I'm kind of half joking when I say become a judge, but it does prepare you if you want to get into the law. You know, even as a lawyer, it's prepared you to deal with different sides of a story, to try to evaluate your client. Do you believe your client? Do you not believe your client? But you can do other things. My stepsister, Leslie, became a therapist, and she now actually consults with family businesses, and handles, you know, possible disputes between and among generations, if you will. But, you know, she had a fabulous background because of the divorce.
Wow. And what happened to that business? She's still doing it.
She's slowed down maybe a tad, but she's flying all over the place, meeting with very wealthy families and trying to help them through various transitions and crises and everything else. I mean, I know something. Most of them are, I can't tell you who they are. Many of them I don't know because it's confidential, but these people, many of whom you know the names.
Wow. So do you think Stan's business helped prepare her for that?
Yeah, because she consults for family businesses. So the exposure to Stan's business, I'm sure, fed into that and gave her a good background.
And what happened to his business?
Well, which one? Dash Your Business Machines, the one that built the machines to emboss and imprint the credit cards, was sold to Hughes Tool Company, Howard Hughes's company, one of Howard Hughes's company. They kind of ran it into the ground, but it was sold there. Then Stan and his friend at the Bank of America set up a company called Uniserve that did extremely well. Then Stan joined with other people in a company called Imodco, International Marine Oil Development Company. That was sold to Amtel Corporation. Then Stan set up another company called Dash Avayer, which was a material handling system and a people mover, kind of a train in a tube. Dash Avayer didn't do that well. It was sold to the Bendix Corporation, but he basically got his investment back and that was it. Mm. Then he built another company called Omni Thruster, which was a bow thruster company. Didn't do well. Stan's getting older now, and he wasn't really, you know, up on his game. Omni Thruster could have done well, but it didn't. He started another company which crashed and burned called Biomixer. And finally, when he needed help walking, he set up a company called Dashaway, which was a walker, but that one didn't do well either. And you know, he didn't live long enough to really see it through.
Wow. So he was quite the entrepreneur.
Constantly.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you had an actor father? An entrepreneur father, right? Exactly. Different lessons from both fathers.
Yeah, you know, the lessons I learned was, I didn't want to take all the risks they did. You know, Stan was risking everything. You know, he put everything on the table with each company, more than he should have. I was much more risk averse than that. Even from childhood, you know, I never broke a bone climbing trees or anything else. And so, you know, to me, I wanted nice, steady pay, which judgeships give you.
Mm.
If good, steady government pay, you're not going to live in the biggest mansion in town, but you're not going to go broke.
Right.
And I saw my father, a freelance actor, you know, sometimes he would get money in, but most of the time, no.
So you wanted security after all that. Wow.
You're gotten that right.
Yeah. So, wow. So, all right. So in closing, we're getting close to the end here. You know, what would you like to leave people with? What is your vision for how this book could impact people?
Well, as I said, it kind of gives you a firsthand look at what it's like to be a kid in a divorced family and then in a blended family, you know, shuttlecocking back and forth between one family and the next every second weekend. It kind of tells you that. It also gives you, I think, a look at life in old Hollywood, because I was exposed to a lot of TV shows and a lot of movies, not A movies, but B movies, and a lot of people in the industry. And it was a little different back then from the way it is now. So I think, you know, reading the book will kind of give you some insight about that. And it'll give you an insight into what it was like as a kid in Beverly Hills. Beverly Hills then was very different from what it is now. It was a small town, really a Mayberry, if you will, surrounded by Los Angeles. And it was a really nice place to be a child, to be a teenager. Very different from today. Very different. So if you read it, you'll see what it was like in high school, what it was like, what we did over the weekends, hanging out on Beverly Drive, going to Biff's for a hamburger or F.W. Woolworth's for an ice cream cone, something like that. It was, and they were just kids. And many were the children of celebrities, including A-list celebrities. My class had, Larry Bishop's child. We had Lee J. Cobb's daughter. Ahead of me was Danny Kaye's daughter. And I could go on. I could give you another 20 names like that. And they were just kids. We didn't treat them any differently from anyone else. The teachers didn't. We were all just kind of the same, which is amazing now because, you know, people were much more focused on celebrity and fame and big names, but that wasn't the case back then.
Mm. It seems like it was a simple time, right?
It was a more simple time. Life was easy. I grant you, we were a bunch of spoiled brats. No question about that. But life was easy. And many of us are still very friendly and keep in touch.
Wow.
Yeah.
Such a great story. So please get, if you have any interest in, well, not interest in being divorced, but if you're from that kind of thing, this might help you. Every other weekend, if you had to go back and forth, if you were with two different families, or you know someone who was, you know, this might help them cope through it and get through it. Every Other Weekend by Anthony J. Moore.
Available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Thrift Books, IndieBound, from my website, anthonyjmoore.com, wherever good literature is sold.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
It was a pleasure. All right. Bye, everyone. See you next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.